Rupert Murdoch and how he got his media empire.
What made Murdoch possible was the FCC. I mean, they're supposed to be the watchdogs, you know, guardians of the public airwaves. And they traditionally have had this whole history of being not the watchdogs so much as the lapdogs. They always bend over backwards for industry rather than the people. And dealing with Murdoch, they weren't lapdogs, they were lap dancers.
That's Marvin Kittman. We'll talk with him about his article in the November Harper's Magazine, Murdoch Triumphant. Then we'll talk about the BP Gulf oil disaster, what allowed it to happen, and what to do about it now.
And then the challenge, of course, is, okay, once we know about the, say, the bluefin tuna that was killed, or the shrimp that were poisoned, or the grass that was killed and therefore eroded away, how do you put a dollar value on that? How do you restore that? That's a very tough question.
That's Peter Lehner of the National Resources Defense Council. The new book he co-wrote is In Deep Water. We'll also bring you a tip on eating for the holidays from nutrition expert Brian Wanzink. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When my internet service was down recently, I went to my local pizza palace to take advantage of their free Wi-Fi. They also have free TV, which is always tuned to the Fox News channel. In airports, bars, and just about any other place where there's a TV for public viewing, I generally find the same. It's Fox News all the time. It's safe to say Rupert Murdoch is the most powerful media mogul in America. He reaches millions through his Orwellian-named company, News Corp, with vast holdings in every kind of media venue, from print to broadcast to movies to the web. My guest, media critic Marvin Kittman, says his media empire is a means to an end, political power. Murdoch's a kingmaker, or a queenmaker. Where would Sarah Palin, now a paid contributor to Fox News, be without Murdoch? How did he manage to get to where he is? It took luck, a willingness to skirt the law, and an FCC that fell down on its job. That's the fascinating tale Marvin Kittman tells in the November issue of Harper's Magazine, and he tells it with scorching panache and style. Kittman says in his article, Murdoch Triumphant, that at 6 a.m. on October 7th, 1996, the Stone Age of American journalism officially began.
That was the start of the Fox News Channel, and that took us from the age of Cronkite and Brokaw to O'Reilly and Hannity, those icons of American journalism. But, you know, whenever I watch the Fox News Channel, I keep thinking back to Rupert Murdoch's arrival in this country. And it really goes back to 1970 when he came here. He was an immigrant lad of 40 who arrived on these shores with only $3 million in his pocket. Of course, they were Australian dollars. And he cobbled together a whole empire. First, he bought newspapers and magazines, and he wasn't satisfied. And what Murdoch in other countries was always a presence. He was a player. He made and broke administrations, you know, which is what he did in England and Australia. But here he was kind of a non-entity, and what he needed was television. And he bought six stations in 1985, the Metro Media Group, and out of that came the whole Fox television empire, and ultimately came the Fox News Channel. The only problem with his purchase of the six stations back in 1985 is that they were illegal,
Well, before we get into that, because I think that's in some ways one of the two beating hearts of your article, you yourself were working as a media critic at one of the stations that he bought. Is that right, Channel 5?
That's right. I was the media critic at Channel 5 before Rupert came, and then afterwards. I was moonlighting there. My basic job was I was the media critic at Newsday for 35 years, and I was always fascinated by Rupert Murdoch and his rise in his country. Yeah, I used to review television on Channel 5 here in New York, and I would get to review Rupert's contributions to American journalism. Before Fox News, there was that great show called A Current Affair. And, so that's what I did. That's when I first became interested in Rupert Murdoch.
And what was that like? What were the changes that you saw in Channel 5, where you were?
Oh, well, Channel 5, you know, I was, when he came there, when the Australian peril hit New York, I thought that the switchboard operator would say, good day, mates, and have a Foster's, and that the new anchorman from the 10 o'clock news that I was on would be Crocodile Dundee or somebody. But the changes were, in terms of the news, they were very subtle then. He, it was a typical news program focusing on crime and everything. But we really didn't get the taste of Murdoch journalism until he started the Fox News Channel.
You say that there were two times in the 1990s, this was, just before he started Fox News, when Murdoch faced a serious challenge to his dominance of the media. The first one was a legal challenge. You said it was illegal. Tell us what was going on.
We have television and radio are regulated by the Communications Act of 1934, and a very important provision of it is Section 310(1A), which says that a television license cannot be granted to a foreign entity. And it turned out that Murdoch's company, News Corp, is a foreign entity, and they are the ones that put up the money for buying the Metro Media stations, including Channel 5. So that was violation number one, that the FCC should have denied granting the licenses to Murdoch's company. The second problem with the sale is that the Communications Act prohibits giving licenses to aliens. Now, at the time, Rupert Murdoch was an alien. He did not become a citizen until 118 days after he had been awarded the license. Now, you can understand why Congress had passed the Communications Act of 1934. You did not want, at the time of World War II, you did not want the German companies having control of a news division at a network, or you did not want the Al-Qaeda front to be able to control a news division. So these were very important parts of the law. But the FCC, and in a very complicated way, turned a blind eye to these violations. And it wasn't until 1994 that the NAACP launched a suit at the FCC to deny renewal of the Channel 5 license. Now, this was a very important case because if they took the license away in Channel 5, then they would have to take the license away from the other cities, Washington, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, etc. And the whole Murdoch empire that was built on these stations would collapse, and Rupert would have been just another foreign interloper, one of those limeys like Robert Maxwell, Conrad Black, that were always trying to stick their nose into the American tent. And he would have gone away back in 1994, 1995, and he would have been concentrating on China, which is really the big goal. Everybody focuses on Murdoch's buying up all the media here, but the really big swag is the Chinese market for media, you know, which is relatively untapped. And Murdoch has been assiduously trying to worm his way into the Chinese media. So at any rate, he would have been gone, and we never would have had Fox News. And I keep thinking about that. Yeah, every time I tune in to get a fair and balanced view of the news.
Yeah. Now, he also was almost stopped by another, a titanic, you say it was a near-mythic clash of titanic personalities, Ted Turner.
Yes, that was the second time we could have stopped Rupert. Now, Ted Turner, Rupert wanted to own the world, the whole media world, and his only rival back in the 1990s was Ted Turner, who also wanted to own the world. And he had merged with Jerry Levin at Time Warner. So when the Fox News Channel was about to start, they had one major problem. They were not in the New York market, the New York cable market. Now, the way New York is the center of the universe, we all know, especially in cable, if a new cable network does not get on the system in New York, they usually DOA, because the Mad Men, the Madison Avenue guys who control the flow of advertising, well, they're very provincial. If it's not on New York, then it doesn't exist. So Turner and Levin and Time Warner owned the exclusive cable franchise in New York called Time Warner Cable Systems. They could have kept off the Fox News Channel. As a matter of fact, they tried in the beginning. They said, oh, we don't have room for another news channel. We have CNN, which, of course, Turner and Levin and Time Warner owned. Sorry, goodbye, you guys can't get in. Well, Murdoch, who had already spent close to $1 billion setting up Fox News, was, needless to say, infuriated. So there then began this war, this media war. The New York Post, which Murdoch owns, launched these attacks on Ted. They had these front page headlines. Is Ted Turner insane? You decide, yes or no. This was the whole front page World War III headlines. They then dug out the old pictures of Mrs. Turner, who was Jane Fonda, and the famous picture of her sitting on the anti-aircraft gun in Vietnam, Hanoi, Jane, the commie slut, as they called her in their objective news reporting. And so this war went on, but Fox News was not going to be on New York, so in a couple of weeks they would have been dead, because you couldn't get advertising. However, that famous lover of a free press, Rudy Giuliani, who was the mayor of New York at the time and who had owed his election to support from the New York Post, decided that this was a big free press issue. The American people, the people of New York, needed Fox News. They needed diversity of opinion. And Rudy Giuliani was making speeches. He's always like Il Duce, making speeches from City Hall balconies about the free press issue. And Turner and Levin and Time Warner stuck to their guns until Mayor Rudy threatened to take away the franchise of Time Warner. And so then Turner finally capitulated, and Levin and Fox News came on the air, and we now know, thanks to that Rudy Giuliani, we now have Fox News Channel. It ultimately, he's responsible for giving us such things as that radio madman Glenn Beck, who became a great success on Fox News, and who has led, all of this has led Jon Stewart to say Bill O'Reilly is the voice of sanity on Fox News.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. And now you have, of course, as you say in your article, Marvin Kipman, Murdoch triumphant, that Murdoch gave $1 million to the Republican Governors Association in this last election cycle and zero to the Democrats.
Well, yeah, the Republicans have always been his favorite charity, and he's given them money in the past. And the thing is, you know, the real villain, I mean, what made Murdoch possible was the FCC. I mean, they're supposed to be the watchdogs, you know, guardians of the public airwaves, and they traditionally have had this whole history of being not the watchdogs so much as the lapdogs. They've always bend over backwards for industry rather than the people, and with dealing with Murdoch, they weren't lapdogs, they were lap dancers, as I called. They let Murdoch get away with so much stuff that I didn't have in the article. For example, one of the sacred laws in media was the cross-ownership. Media moguls were not allowed to own television or radio stations in the same market that they own newspapers. Now, in Murdoch's case, he already owned the New York Post, and the FCC allowed him to buy to own Channel 5 in New York, you know, which is a violation. And what they did was back in 1985, they gave him a temporary waiver, as they called it, and he still operates on a temporary waiver. What is that, 25 years, 35 years?
Yeah.
So, and then the other rule that they had is that you could not own more than one television station in one market. So so the FCC gave Murdoch what is called a duopoly. Now, a duopoly means having more than one station in the same market. Now, here in New York, they have Murdoch owns not only Channel 5, WNYW, or they also own Channel 9. So, of course, what's happened, the first thing that happened is they practically eliminated the Channel 9 newscast, and, you know, it's redundant. So these are, they've always, the FCC has, you know, really been manipulated by Murdoch, and it's to Murdoch's credit that he knows how to do it, and because he's done it in the United Kingdom and Australia. You know, he's very gifted that way. He can find openings, loopholes in laws that he could fly a Qantas 747 through. He's very gifted that way. So they're the real villains. And the FCC, you know, has always been pushed around by the industry it's supposed to regulate. But there is one rule that was really sacred. It was called lack of candor. The only time they would take away a TV license or a radio license is for lack of candor by the purchaser of the station. By lack of candor, they mean lying. Now, you know, when the licenses were issued to Murdoch, the company lied to the FCC about the ownership. And the way they did it is they had like four levels of companies that they kept shuffling the ownership around, and it left the FCC totally confused. And it wasn't until this license, the petition to deny by the NAACP, that their lawyers were managing to chart the organization. It was so buried that the FCC never found out that the News Corp, the foreign entity, actually owned the station. But for lack of candor, in the past, in the 75 years that the law has been around, there was only one case where a company was found to have displayed lack of candor. And that was back in the 1980s, the famous RKO General tire case. RKO General owned six television stations and 11 radio stations, and the FCC, after investigating them for 3 or 4 years, found that they were shown lack of candor in telling them General Tire was bribing foreign governments and also falsifying the ad rates in Boston and L.A. And so the FCC ruled because of lack of candor. They took away the licenses. That's what inspired me about this whole thing, that the FCC should have found the lack of candor, and there was all kinds of evidence. You know, I can't discuss all the evidence here, that they had shown a lack of candor and that the licenses should have been taken away from them, and then we wouldn't have had Fox News, etc., etc. And, you know, when I got involved in this story, I kept thinking, this is all well and good, and we could theoretically learn from history because they always repeat their mistakes. History repeats itself. And if it was up to me, I would have the Justice Department, the Cold Case Division, to reopen this case to investigate why that the FCC was derelict of its duty and to re-examine these licenses. It's never too late to take the licenses away.
Marvin Kittman talking about Murdoch Triumphant, his latest article for Harper's Magazine. It's in the November issue. In addition to writing for Harper's, Kittman is the author of The Man Who Would Not Shut Up, The Rise of Bill O'Reilly, and I Am a VCR, which recounts Kittman's 2 decades as a TV critic for Newsday.
These people are planning our destruction. The evidence is overwhelming.
Fox News Alert.
These people are simply dangerous.
Fox News Alert.
We're just not smart enough to realize what's going to happen.
Up next tonight, the latest fright. With truth so truthful it hurts. Fox News Alert.
The former 9/11 commission issued a scathing report today that gave failing grades to the federal government for inadequacies.
Amid calls for an immediate end to the war in Iraq, the U.S. Senate passed a bill this week pressing the administration
The world is infested with sick individuals. So many imminent threats.
Fox News Alert.
Chemical weapons and gay marriage. It's happening now, right on your set. Fox News Alert. You're all gonna die. Fox News Alert. Don't you wanna know why?
We already know that the Pakistani crazies can design a nuclear device, and we already know that anybody can sneak in here.
What's coming next? You better prepare. Gotta stay on your toes. It's good to be scared. Keeping you posted on threats to beware. Fox News will protect you. We're here cause we care. Balanced and fair. Fox News Alert.
A clip from the YouTube movie Fox News Alert. Go to writersvoice.net for a link. Food psychologist Brian Wansink wants us to eat more mindfully. When we spoke to him in 2006 about his book Mindless Eating, he had some tips on how to be more mindful for the holiday season. Here's a brief excerpt from that interview. We're broadcasting this, unfortunately, the day after Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm sure people will still have plenty of leftovers.
Oh, they will.
So this will be good advice for them. And I tell you the truth, I'm always afraid, you know, because I love Thanksgiving and I love the good food. But I know that when I see the groaning board that has, you know, 20 different dishes on it and 5 different desserts, well, I want to have a little taste of each one of them. And even if I just take a tablespoon of each one. Well, I end up with, the Himalayan mountains on my plate.
Oh, that is true. Well, there's a couple things to do in that case like that. If it's a buffet line, what you can do is you can just simply put two items on your plate at any one time and kind of go back, and that ends up being nice because you eat the things you like best first. And eventually, going back for thirds or fourths is okay, but not fifths or sixths, and you decide you've had enough. That's one thing. A better thing to do if you're doing a sit-down dinner with other people is, when you do this, use what we call the half-plate rule. Now, a lot of us don't have a benchmark as to what's right to eat and how much to eat, but if you use the half-plate rule, it gives you that benchmark. The half-plate rule is you simply say, look, half my plate, I can put anything I want to. The other half of the plate has to be fruits, or has to be, you know, vegetables, salads, and fruits. If the other half is all meat and carbs, hey, that's fine. But at least half the plate has to be vegetables, fruits, and salads. What that leads people to do is at least to fill up in some of the less calorie-dense stuff.
Right. And so they're actually eating healthily, and then they're not quite so hungry. But what about that dessert pouch? You know, there's that extra dessert pouch. Because no matter how much I fill up on the vegetables, I'm still ready to eat three desserts if they're in front of me.
Well, one thing you can do with desserts is you can see them as part of a larger meal. So, for instance, you don't want to go through the entire meal kind of complaining about how you're on a diet and how it's ruining your diet. Because, you know, you're going to have less fun, and believe me, everybody around you is not going to be grateful for it either. So one thing to do is to give yourself the freedom to eat some of the things you want by saying, hey, look, you know, in addition to the main central dishes, you know, I can have two other items. That could be, you know, the appetizer or the chips that were passed around before the dinner. It could be the bread that's passed around at dinner. It could be wine if you're having wine, or it could be a dessert. You can have any two of those items, but you can't have all four. The problem with desserts comes in not necessarily because of the dessert, but because of the fact that prior to that dessert, we had had the bread. We had had all the appetizers that were passed around. We had had all the side dishes.
And does this work for you too at Thanksgiving dinner?
Yeah. In some cases, there's some meals that just really aren't really worth monitoring tremendously closely.
Right.
And like a Thanksgiving dinner, if a person was on a cruise and trying to watch their weight, well, that's sort of a bad idea. You shouldn't be on a cruise because you're losing all the advantage of being on a cruise. In some situations, hey, they come around so seldom, it's not really worth obsessing about that one situation. Hey, but tell you what, the day after Thanksgiving, 2 days after Thanksgiving, 3 days after Thanksgiving, for the 3 weeks before
Christmas,
the holidays start again, mm-hmm. You can watch what you do. And then it becomes very easy coming up with some of these very small changes that can lead you to mindlessly eat less, can put you on the right track, keep you on track, even though Thanksgiving was a blowout.
Brian Wansink is the director of the Cornell Food and Brand Lab. His book is Mindless Eating: Why We Eat More Than We Think. Next up, we'll talk with Peter Lehner of the National Resources Defense Council about the BP oil disaster in the Gulf. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On April 20th, BP's Deepwater Horizon's well blew out. The massive explosion that followed took 11 lives, decimated one of the world's prime fishing grounds, and took the livelihoods of countless residents of the Gulf. Why did it happen? What happens now? And how can such accidents be avoided in the future? My guest, Peter Lehner, explores these issues in the new book he co-wrote with Bob Deans, In Deep Water, The Anatomy of a Disaster, The Fate of the Gulf, and How to End Our Oil Addiction. Lehner has a background as an environmental prosecutor, including prosecuting oil cases. Now he's the executive director of the National Resources Defense Council, or NRDC. Bob Deans heads up communications for the group. I spoke with Peter Lehner earlier this November. You know, we just saw pictures published of the dying coral reefs. Are we really being told the true scope of this disaster?
Well, the real truth is we don't exactly know the scope of the disaster. This was the first time we'd ever had an oil spill this deep underwater. And, of course, it was 10 times bigger than the Exxon Valdez oil spill. And we really don't know how oil works underwater. So we have a, I think nobody is deceiving us as to what we see on the surface, but what we don't know is what the oil is doing underwater. And it does keep popping up in different places. We're finding it on areas that used to be clean, get oiled again by underwater plumes. New evidence shows that the underwater currents aren't necessarily where we thought they were. So I don't think we're not being told the truth so much as that we don't know.
And the impact is not just environmental. It's also on what I think the BP chairman called the small people. There was a recent article in Orion magazine by Terry Tempest Williams that talked about the impact on people and how they're really getting slammed. Do you know something of that as well?
Oh, of course. Well, first of all, of course, 11 people died, and we shouldn't forget that. And we also know that thousands of people were put out of work, and these are people who, many of them, did not have huge savings accounts or a lot of other job opportunities. So when the fishery and the shrimpery and the oyster beds were closed, they were without resources. And it's also important, we've heard a lot of talk about all the people on the oil rigs who might have been less employed because of the moratorium, but 10 times as many people work in the tourism and fishery industries as work in the oil industry in the Gulf of Mexico. And many of those were put out of work. All the people who did not go to take their vacations on the Gulf Coast, and therefore then all the people who work in those restaurants and hotels didn't have the same jobs as they would have. So tremendous human toll here. And remember, this is an area that was already devastated by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita and, frankly, was feeling somewhat abandoned by the country. And then this comes along, and they're feeling hit pretty hard.
There's been a lot of talk about compensation and the compensation fund. How is that effort going?
It's moving forward. Of course, Kenneth Feinberg, who was the administrator of the 9/11 fund, is also administering this fund that BP has set aside, and claims are being paid. But, of course, you get different stories from different people. When I spent time down in the Gulf, I heard from plenty of people who noted that the claims process was slow and that after the first couple months, the average claims paid were much less. And for many people, this was when, say, school was starting and they had to start thinking about school supplies. Remember also that for a lot of people who were fishermen or crabbers or oystermen, they not only made their living through fishing, but they also got a lot of food that they ate through the fish they caught or the crabs and oysters they pulled up. And because there were concerns of the safety, these folks now didn't want to eat that and shouldn't have been eating the food lest it be unsafe, and so had an additional cost as well as losing a job. So the claims process is helping, but it's clearly not resolving all the really horrific human suffering there.
And you're an environmental lawyer. I mean, how does one even begin to encompass what is compensatable here? I mean, it just seems that there are short-term impacts, but there are huge long-term impacts, and they can include the health of residents as well as the health of the environment.
They are indeed, and there are different legal mechanisms to try to address each one. There are these claims that we've talked about. There's a provision under the law that provides for what are called natural resource damages, and that will require a study of where the oil went, what it did to the natural resources. And the natural resources, of course, include all the animals, the grasses, the corals, all the other living aspects of this very complex and rich ecosystem. And then the challenge, of course, is, okay, once we know about the, say, the bluefin tuna that was killed, or the shrimp that were poisoned, or the grass that was killed and therefore eroded away, how do you put a dollar value on that? How do you restore that? That's a very tough question. And in addition, there are all the human claims, but those, again, will be handled through either this claims process or through the court system. And those are often, we've had experience with those types of claims before, lost wages, sickness, even emotional stress. All of those, we hope, can be handled. The real hope will be, can they be handled quickly enough and without such tremendous cost that the whatever money, it goes to those who have suffered and to them very quickly.
And this is all unfolding within a political context, you know, one that's, as you point out in your book, In Deep Water, has not been notably friendly to the cost to the environment and to human beings, as opposed to companies of their operations, of companies' operations. In other words, what I'm saying is that the regulatory framework has become more and more difficult.
That is certainly true. What we talk about in our book, In Deep Water, is that even as we were pushing the envelope and drilling in more and more challenging places, the national consensus, which had existed 30 or 40 years ago for adequate and vigilant government oversight of these risky activities, because somebody has to make sure that these guys are playing by the rules and are protecting the public health, and protecting our environment, that consensus had broken down, so that the oversight had really disintegrated. And that is not happenstance. That is in part because of a tremendous campaign funded in large part by the oil industry and many of others to make sure that they could keep doing what they wanted to do. The oil industry is extraordinarily powerful. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars lobbying, and they get much of what they seek.
Yeah, so we all heard about MMS being, you know, literally in bed with the oil companies in some cases. There's also the whole issue of subsidies. I mean, it's more than just regulation. Talk about kind of the larger way in which government seems to, well, I hate to say it, but is in the pockets of these companies.
It is very much so. As we point out in the book, between 2002 and 2008, the oil and gas industry received $51 billion in federal subsidies and tax treatment. And that's in addition to the general manufacturing and investment tax breaks that business gets. So those are 51 extra billion dollars that the oil industry gets. Now, that only includes direct subsidies. That doesn't include the fact that they are allowed to do something like this drilling without adequate oversight and therefore not paying the full cost of doing it safely. They're not paying the cost of making sure that they don't pollute the air and pollute the water and, frankly, just significantly alter and change our climate. So they are getting tremendous subsidies from us, but we pay. It's a real fallacy to think that we don't pay. We just don't always pay at the pump in terms of the gas price. We just pay in terms of our health care costs, our military costs, and in many other ways.
Yeah, in fact, you have an incredible list here. You say that most people have no idea what's required from an economic, personal, political, technological, diplomatic, industrial, military, or environmental standpoint to provide this country with the oil we depend on. That's an awful lot to be ignorant about.
It is, and again, that's partly because it's partly our fault. We like to hop in our car and not think about what's behind that the gas pump. but it is also partly the fault of the oil industry that have been lobbying hard and advertising hard to try to make sure that we don't think about that.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Peter Lehner of the National Resources Defense Council about the Gulf oil disaster and what should be done about it. He co-wrote the new book, In Deep Water, with Bob Deans. You know, after the spill, the blowout happened at the Deepwater Horizon, it seemed to a lot of us, and certainly to me as we were looking, that it took Obama an awfully long time to kind of insert himself into the process and try to hold BP's feet to the fire. He seemed hapless in the face of this. Why do you think that happened? Why did it take him so long to respond?
Well, I think, to be fair, there was just so much we didn't know. And I'll be honest, I remember being interviewed on the day the spill happened, and the interviewer wanted me to say that this would be a terrible spill. And I said, to be honest, we don't know. It's 40 miles offshore. It just started. At that point, we didn't know how big it was, how much oil was gushing out every day. And we didn't know whether it would be capped in a day or in 100 days. And so it was, at first, the thought that it might have been a much smaller spill. You remember that day by day, the estimates of how much oil was spilling out were going up and up. So I think I'm not trying to excuse what the president did or didn't do, but it was a time of great confusion. And what that really goes to is the need for more oversight. We need better safety standards, and we need more accurate oversight so that we don't find ourselves in a position where we don't know what's going on. What was really most disturbing here, in addition to the fact that we were using technology that we could handle if all went well, but the minute it went wrong, we didn't handle it, and we ended up using the same cleanup technologies we used 20 and 30 years ago, was that the lack of oversight meant that we didn't know. And that, I think, was what's really at fault here. And that's what we could make some changes, and President Obama has made some very good changes in the agencies, but some changes require Congress to act, and that's where, frankly, we're very frustrated with the U.S. Senate. The House of Representatives has passed a bill that would improve oversight of drilling in these areas, and the Senate hasn't acted, and we are hopeful they will act in this lame duck session, but frankly, it's the paralysis in Washington is very frustrating. But absent action by the Senate, we can only make certain changes. We can't go all the way.
Wow. You know, Obama did put in a moratorium for a while. He had to withstand an enormous firestorm of criticism for that. Talk about this idea of a moratorium precisely to try to find out, you know, what we don't know and what we can, you know, what we can know about this.
Right. And NRDC was very supportive of the moratorium and thinks it was the right thing for exactly the reason that was stated, which is until we know exactly what happened, let's go a little more slowly on the drilling because we can't afford to have a second spill like this. And we had a National Academy of Engineering commission, a Coast Guard commission, and, of course, the president's bipartisan commission all looking into this oil spill. And they are getting a lot of information as to what has happened. The president's oil spill commission is meeting, in fact, yesterday and today, and getting a lot of detailed information about how the drilling process works. Remember, this is the drill that goes through a mile of water, and then at the seafloor is a mile deep, and then it drills into 18,000 feet over 3 miles of stone and rock to get to this reservoir of oil. This is tough and confusing technology. So let's figure out what's going on before we continue this. Now, there was a lot of political backlash because people were saying, oh, my goodness, look at all the oil workers put out of work. But that was really, frankly, misleading on a number of fronts. First, as I mentioned, many, many more people work in the tourism and the fishing industry than in the oil industry, and those people were put out of work by the spill. And what President Obama was trying to ensure is that we didn't have that that larger group of people put out of work for even longer if there's any other accidents like this.
Not to speak of people dying.
And not to speak of people dying, of course. And the second is that, in fact, there were many fewer job losses in the oil industry than a lot of the hysteria indicated, because, after all, these rigs are big, complicated systems, and they don't just turn on and off in a switch. So many of them continued to keep a lot of staff there doing some repairs and upgrades and maintenance during the time that they weren't actively drilling. And, of course, there are many wells that were near shore and that were already active, and those weren't affected. So there are a lot of different factors here that suggest, in our view, that the moratorium was a wise decision, given what we know and what we don't know.
We're talking with Peter Lehner. He is the executive director of the NRDC and co-author with Bob Deans of In Deep Water, The Anatomy of a Disaster, The Fate of the Gulf, and How to End Our Oil Addiction. It is a fascinating deconstruction of the forces behind the BP oil disaster at the Deepwater Horizon. And we're talking with him on November 9th. Now, there was more than BP involved in this. There was Transocean and Halliburton in addition to BP. Things seem to be heating up on the legal front. There's the circular firing squad between these companies going on. Talk about that, and how should we apportion the blame here?
Well, Francesca, you know, I've been an environmental prosecutor before, and I personally handled some oil spill cases, so I'm going to tread a little carefully right now. The blame should be apportioned according to each party's role and responsibilities, and we have investigations going on, the commissions I mentioned. We also will have civil and criminal investigations proceeding, and those will really determine exactly who said what to when, who had the responsibility to handle which aspects of the drilling, and then who should be held responsible. And then, of course, there's contractual possibilities between and among the companies that could provide for one company indemnifying another. So we're going to have to work all of this out. I think the real takeaway for your listeners, for all of us, is that although it might make interesting theater to watch BP, Halliburton, Transocean fight amongst themselves, the real issue is that we allowed this inherently risky activity to move forward without adequate oversight, and we allowed it to move forward because we are so desperately thirsty for oil. We use a vast amount of oil every day, and as a result, we are willing to make tremendous sacrifices to get that oil. Sacrifices, whether it be in the Gulf of Mexico, on our own lands, whether it be to our foreign balance of trade and our national security. And the good news here is that we actually can cut our oil use dramatically in half or more if we just stop wasting it. One of the extraordinary things is here is this very valuable stuff. We make tremendous sacrifices to get it. And then what do? We use it in gas-guzzling, wasteful cars. We design our transportation system so that we're always, every individual is hopping into a car to do almost anything. Our mass transit systems are falling behind those of many, many other countries. And we are using it in plastics that we throw away and in houses that are leaky. So here is this crazy situation where we are putting our country and ourselves at risk, and we have this opportunity to stop wasting this oil. And the good news is we're making some progress. President Obama has started moving forward on increasing the efficiency of cars and trucks, and that will go a long, long way. We just need to go a lot further.
Yeah, we do. And we just had an election where there were a lot of folks who are now newly in the U.S. Congress who don't even believe in climate change and who seem to have no interest in stopping the wastage of oil. How your organization, Natural Resources Defense Council, is in favor of something called environmental economics, working with companies, along with the Environmental Defense Fund, working with companies to turn them into a more responsible environmental citizens. BP was supposedly one of those citizens. Put out a whole lot of propaganda about being beyond petroleum. How do you work with companies that may have two very different faces? They may be doing some really important things to stop wasting energy, and on the other hand, they may be doing some very damaging things as well.
Well, Francesca, we take a number of approaches. First of all, with any individual company, we recognize that those are big, complicated entities, and so we take each of their activities separately. And there are some companies that, frankly, at the same time that we are working with them on some policy changes, we may actually be suing them for their pollution. And so many of them, it may not be just one answer how we work with them. The second is that it's important to think these companies don't work in a vacuum. They work in the context of our society, in the context of our marketplace. So we work with the companies both directly, what they can do individually, but we also have to work with them to shape the marketplace, to shape the rules so that good environmental behavior is rewarded and bad environmental behavior is punished. Right now, too often, it is the dirty energy that has the economic advantage over the clean energy, and that is a crazy system. And so we work with the companies both to make sure that clean energy can be competitive and provide the quality of life that we want, at the same time change the rules so that the dirty energy doesn't get the benefits that it gets now. The challenge, of course, is that the dirty energy companies, the coal and oil industries, are spending hundreds of millions of dollars to keep their perks, and so that's where the real battle is.
You're right, and we saw that influence in the last election with the billions being poured into the Tea Party movement by Charles and his brother, David Cook, or Koch, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce that. They own one of the biggest energy companies in the world, if not the biggest. How are we going to deal with this in this era after Citizens United, after, you know, the changes in Congress? What can we do as citizens?
I think it's really important to get out there and get that voice heard and make sure that you can't take anything for granted. The Tea Party, which got a lot of media attention, actually doesn't represent a huge portion of America. On the other hand, they were very loud. And those people, what we see is that the polling strongly supports clean energy and clean air. In California, where there was a direct fight against the oil companies trying to roll back California's clean energy global warming solutions law, that effort was rejected by 21 points at the California polls. Around the country, when people can vote on actual clean energy and clean air issues, they are very supportive. Now, of course, people vote big packages, but so often the support for this is quiet, and the support for other positions can be loud. So it's very important that people make sure their voice gets heard, and actually start participating. And that, of course, is what we are trying to do. We have the facts on our side. There's no question that stopping wasting energy, using our oil more efficiently in efficient cars, in more efficient trucks, using rail transport to mass transit, which, by the way, having just been stuck in a traffic jam this morning, there's no question the subway is a better way to get around. As we move towards this, it will be better for our economy, it will be better for our national security, it will be better for the job possibilities, and of course it will be better for our health. So we've got the facts on our side, we just have to make sure people aren't complacent.
Are there some specific legislative campaigns or campaigns that NRDC is doing right now that people can find out more about and get involved in?
Anyone, we would certainly invite anyone, your listeners, Francesca, to come to our website, nrdc.org, and those legislative campaigns, of course, change frequently. We're now in what's called the lame duck, after the election, before the new Congress takes place. And exactly what Congress will do in this next couple months is not crystal clear. I can't tell you right now what are the main campaigns in the short term. In the longer term, when the new Congress comes back, we will certainly continue to push for clean energy, for improvements in our health, preventing pollution and protecting clean air. There will be tremendous efforts by the dirty industries, by the fossil fuel industries, to make sure that that there are rollbacks of our public health protections. There are, though, EPA is moving forward to continue its requirements under the Clean Air Act to protect our health and our air. And there are going to be a lot in the coal and oil industry are going to be pushing to repeal that or to delay EPA's ability to protect us. And those are the fights that we hope your listeners and others will help us with.
And we will link to that. You know, just one last question. I saw in the New York Times today, it's November 9th, as we're talking here, that the environmental movement is going back to using the Montreal Protocol that was used to control sulfur dioxide pollution pretty successfully to deal with the ozone hole, or maybe it was for the CFCs.
It was for the CFCs,
right?
Yeah.
Is beginning to apply that now. Is it just being applied to the newer what replaced the CFCs before, or is it there some way that it can be used for greenhouse gases in general?
Well, I think that is what there's a whole range of greenhouse gases, of course, and one of the questions is whether or not the Montreal Protocol approach, which was really, if you think about it, and now I'm going to oversimplify, rather than trying to put a limit and establish a trading scheme or putting a price on carbon, as almost all economists would recommend putting a price on carbon in one way or another. Rather than doing that, what the Montreal Protocol did is largely phase out certain chemicals that we knew were very, very harmful. And the question is, are there some other greenhouse gases that we can just try to phase out rather than using a more complicated market-based system? And we can certainly do that for any replacements that replace the CFCs, but can we use that approach more broadly? And that, I think, is an important element to think about. There was certainly a time at the beginning of this millennium, at 5-10 years ago, when it seemed that every solution had to be, quote, market-based. And it was unclear what that meant, but straight prohibition of really dangerous chemicals, which we had done, frankly, for the previous 40 years, was considered a weapon that was too crude to protect our health. Now people are realizing it was actually a very effective weapon to protect our health. Industry very quickly adopted and found substitutes that were profitable and effective. So companies could deal with this. The rules were clear, and public health was protected. So I think we are looking more broadly, and hopefully we'll find other opportunities.
That's great. Peter Lehner, your book you've written with Bob Deans, the book In Deep Water, The Anatomy of a Disaster, The Fate of the Gulf, and How to End Our Oil Addiction. And we'll be linking to the NRDC website, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Well, Francesca, it's a pleasure, and I hope you and your readers enjoy the book. It's available in bookstores and on internet online booksellers, so I hope they enjoy it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Peter Lehner of the National Resources Defense Council. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.